You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. We're online here at kpcg.fm, live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And this is Trumpet Radio Live, weekend edition. Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau with you here today. Started out the weekend here with a little bit of a rain, which was nice. We had some, Monday I guess it was, pretty good rainstorm. And we've had some good rain and chance for some throughout the weekend too, so... I was talking a while ago about how when it gets really dry, my lawn starts to crack and open up. So slowly starting to go back together with this this moisture.
Yeah, hopefully it doesn't become a waterfall in there.
We'll never find out what's down there at the bottom of that giant crevice, thankfully. So it's good. It was a little bit dry, so we're getting some of that rain back that we needed. And hopefully getting rain where you're listening, too. A lot of people online at kpcg.fm, if you need it. and a lot of places do here in the U.S. We had that heat dome going on for a while where it was very warm. And then, of course, California had fires and drought and so forth. So a lot of areas could use some good rain, and it's always nice to get that. A lot to talk about on today's program, some headlines to discuss. Also, the Key of David program, we'll preview that. And the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Brent Nachtigall today from Jerusalem, bringing that to you. And then we'll talk about some things that have happened on this day in history as well. Well, everyone can take a big deep breath, a sigh of relief. The conventions are over. all that pomp and circumstance is over with. Some people get upset because it's on television and that takes away some of the shows they like. There's a show, it's called The Bachelorette, I believe.
Right.
And I saw a story where people were upset because it got cut off or they didn't see all of it because they had to go to one of the conventions. Don't take away my shows.
It's kind of funny. Well, my opinion, I think the convention was more entertaining than any reality show you can think of in many ways. So, but yeah, it's amazing. I think maybe expected for American networks. But as a foreigner, it's amazing just how much coverage there is of it. It's even when there's nothing going on, they just have commercial break after commercial break, but it's still like live coverage of the convention. So it is important, but just wall-to-wall coverage, and now hopefully the news cycle can get back a little more normal maybe.
One of the headlines I saw about just the conventions in general, if you look at the RNC and the DNC, they said it's fear versus fantasy. The RNC was fear, and the DNC was fantasy. So, lots of different takes out there. And then I guess we've got the debates coming up, and not too many months, and then the actual election. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I don't know if people wager on that. I imagine they do because people wager on all kinds of things. But I haven't seen much about what people's predictions are. It's pretty close. I guess Trump's had a little bit of a lead.
Yeah, I think it's. Well, over the last couple of years, we've seen how poorly polls can perform.
That's
so
true.
I think people are a little more skeptical of them now, and especially since it was neck and neck. Trump's pulling ahead right now. It's still not by a whole lot, but it is interesting to see also voter turnout, too, if that affects things and all that. So. Just a lot of different factors coming into this, and we're coming down to the last stretch, I guess.
The home stretch. It'll be interesting. I watched a speech last night, Hillary Clinton's speech, and I felt bad for her husband. they kept showing him on the camera, on the screen, and it looked like he was either really deep in thought or he was sleeping. I'm not sure which one it was. It was her big moment, the big speech, and he looked like he'd had a long day. Saw it. There's some video clips of that up today. I don't know if he was sleeping or he was just resting or what, but everyone was kind of cheering, and he didn't look like he was paying attention at that exact moment. So that's a long day. I mean, can't fault the guy, I guess.
Yeah, well, he gave his big speech, and I think yelling and cheering and all that wears anyone out, especially just how long it drags on. They had like five speeches before her speech or however many it was. So,
And he's not a young guy. I mean, he's getting older too. So,
yeah.
So it can be a long day. So kind of interesting to see some of that. And, there's a lot of write-ups all over about what people thought about, the promises that are being made on both sides, one way or the other, the fact checking, all of that. And so we don't need to get into all that, I guess, because it's everywhere. So needless to say, not everything was accurate that was said on either side of it. Some headlines to talk about here. This is this one, it didn't reach the top of the headlines immediately. I think all the DNC news was kind of on the top. But it's starting to come up to the top a little more, and it's an important headline. Fox News, one San Diego officer killed, another wounded in a shooting. Been quite a few of these lately. One San Diego police officer was killed, another one wounded when a driver they stopped Thursday night opened fire on them in the latest in a series of cop shootings around the nation. The suspected shooter was arrested, and police said they were not pursuing any other suspects. Neither the police officers nor the alleged gunman's names were immediately released. The other officer is still in, I think, surgery, the last I saw. They don't know exactly how he'll do. According to the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund, the number of officers fatally shot is already up 56% compared with last year.
Yeah, this is pretty sobering, and I think it's a good reminder to people who have maybe been, we've all been following the conventions, but that words and warm rhetoric doesn't wash away our problems. And I mean, this might be completely unconnected to the police violence we've seen previous, but still it's a reminder that there are some big problems, and violence against law enforcement is one of the major topics, and there needs to be some practical action, and there are some pretty big problems they're going to have to face, whoever the next leader of America is.
Yeah, it's always kind of a tough, it was tough for Hillary Clinton in her speech to try to portray this opposite view of America from what Donald Trump said. So the view is more of like, things are pretty good and we can make them better. But then at the same time, there are some pretty big issues. And even the current administration, which she is sort of trying to support, but yet create her own identity. They've been very quick to talk about racism in this country or problems like that. She touched on it just a little bit in her speech and then kind of moved on. But it's kind of hard to say things are great on one hand and then the other hand say yes, but there are all these problems and this violence against officers. And this it's hard to make both of those arguments meet up into one succinct message. And I think they're struggling trying to portray things as great when the headlines aren't great.
Right, yeah, it is a dichotomy, and I think that does show why someone like Donald Trump has support, is because he accepts that there are problems and maybe has a more realistic approach to how he presents them to people. So people, I mean, they're very upset about right-wing populist uprisings, but in reality it's their own fault for not addressing them. I mean, when you say everything's fine in America, it's already great, like we don't need to worry about it. Well, people living here don't agree with you. And you, if you don't address what people are thinking and their needs and their fears, it's hard to get them on your side. And that's why now just playing on their fears isn't good either. But at the same time, there seems like there's no middle ground. It's one extreme or the other. And neither is necessarily grounded in reality.
One of the parts, I think, of Hillary's speech, and this ties into our next headline here, one of the parts of her speech I think was kind of tough for her to try to navigate was she said, well, the current administration, they pulled us out of the brink of, you know, economic catastrophe, and they've done a great job, but we're not there yet. So, and a lot of you are really upset, and I understand that, and that's kind of hard to juggle that, because you're saying the previous administration did a great job, but I understand a lot of people are very frustrated. It's kind of hard to put those two together. Well, today the headline, U.S. economy grew less than forecast. It only grew 1.2% in the second quarter. So here today, that's what she said is true. People are kind of upset, a lot of them, about the economy, and it's not growing. Now, they'll tell you it's great. Some people will. Some people say it's not. But it's not growing. It's stagnant. The growth is 1.2%, which is hardly anything. They were expecting it to be 2.5, which isn't great either, but it's less than what they expected. So again, they're trying to juggle this, hey, things are pretty good, but we can make them better. And then the headlines are saying, it's not growing like we thought it would.
Yeah, this is interesting because the economy is always a big issue. In fact, I think a lot of people think it is the issue in a lot of ways. And like you said, there's so many opinions on it. Well, which one's right? But when you see numbers like this, it's clear that it's not doing well, and that there are a lot of Band-Aids on the economy right now that make it look okay, or it covers the wound. So when you put a Band-Aid on your arm or cover up a flesh wound, you can't see it, and you know something's wrong with it, but you don't know what it is because you can't see it. And that's really what this administration has done to the economy. We're almost $20 trillion in debt. I mean, that's a huge problem in itself, besides all the other issues we're talking about.
Which wasn't really addressed that I heard at all. That's a huge, huge issue, obviously. And some of the fact-checking that some different news sites have done, one of the things Hillary mentioned in her speech was something about putting a lot of money into getting the economy going, infrastructure, roads, bridges, that type of thing, which I think would be great. I mean, if they could afford it, which I don't think they can, but some roads could sure use some repair. It would help us save on our car repairs. We don't have to drive over those massive potholes all the time. But so anyway, she talked about wanting to throw a lot of money into this, and she said it'd be the biggest investment in a long time. Well, for the President Obama, remember $800 billion or whatever that he threw in to try to get things going? It wouldn't be that big. So it's been done recently, and it hasn't had any good results, or at least not very many.
Yeah, it's really a pittance compared to what's actually needed to rehaul our infrastructure, because it is old, and most of it was built in like 60s and 70s, the major ones anyway. Some are newer, but so it does need a big overhaul. But yeah, people always forget to ask, well, where's the money going to come from? And they can print it, or they get it from our taxes. And if we've seen how much money they've printed, and they're kind of near the end of that just because of inflation. And now they're talking about negative inflation, all these different things, that the next step is, well, they'll have to raise taxes in order to do all these things we want. And we've already seen that in different wealth gathering schemes or legislation, like the Obamacare and that kind of thing, where it does gather more of our money for the federal government to use. So, they make all these promises, but when you look at the numbers, it's like there is no money to give really to anything.
Yeah,
we can barely make our interest payments on our debt.
Well, and another a thing that they want to do, or they talk about, Hillary Clinton talked about trying to bring the Bernie Sanders supporters with her, is one of his big plans, which is free college. I mean, that sounds great. I mean, who wouldn't like a free college? But again, who's going to pay for it? Who's paying the professors? Who's paying the upkeep of the university, just the buildings? Who's paying for those things? And I saw a little bit of a news report from, I think it was a few months back, but one reporter was asking this protester. It was a young college student, a lady, and she was protesting that school costs too much, and she wanted it to be free. And he said, okay, well who's going to pay for that? And she said, well, the 1% will pay for it all. They have all the money. I don't know. No one's ever named who these people are. I know there are people that have quite a bit of money, but it's like this a sort of mythological group.
Right.
They've got all the money and they're hiding it. And so the reporter brought out some numbers and said, well, look, if you're in a certain income bracket, you get taxed a lot. You know, and some people, he's like, how much do you want them to get taxed? I mean, some people, do you want people to get taxed 90% of their wealth? Is that what you're asking? How much is enough? And she said, well, just keep taxing until we can pay for all the school for everybody. And he said, well, if you made that much money, would you give up 90% of it? And she, yeah, I would. And he's like, come on, come on. And really, even just the... Let's assume there are this 1% out there with all this money. Is that even fair? Should they have to pay for everybody? I mean, where's the fairness in that? It's just this idea that this group is hiding all this gold, you know, under their bed or something. Who are these people that have all this money to throw out there to artificially
inflate this economy that we're in.
Right. Well, I mean, in reality, that's just a communist Marxist narrative that goes back to the very first Communist Manifesto, that there are these capitalist monopolies that dominate the economy. They have all the money, and the proletariat, the common working people, need to cause a revolution and get all their wealth so we all can be wealthy and equal. So, I mean, that this is not new. This is an idea. It's being expressed in different terms now with the free education. But it's the same idea, the same movement that's been done time and time again. It never works because it's not true. Because even capitalism, it doesn't work. It just would undermine the foundations of our society as well. I mean, there's so many things wrong with it. But at the same time, it is really revealing, I think, too, just on how people don't, they'll support something with all their might, but they don't understand it at all. I mean, just the, to a lot of people, that seems ridiculous, but to them, it's worth protesting and throwing and voting for someone to be the next leader for. So it's dangerous too, because it does show how deeply communist ideas are becoming popular when we're in a capitalist country. And a lot of the reasons why we are so prosperous is because we have, partly, it's not all the reasons at all, but that capitalism has allowed this form of society to develop, where if you work hard, if you have a talent or an idea, you can be successful to a certain, whatever degree you seek to endeavor, because that's the principle behind it.
Well, and too, if you think about it, if everything was free, well, first of all, a lot of the degrees aren't worth a lot. You know, if it's a subject that's not needed, I mean, you could get a million people to get the same degree, but if there's 5,000 jobs, well, kind of what difference does it make at that point? And also, it is a matter of you need jobs. There has to be a demand for the job. Just because you have an extra degree doesn't mean anything necessarily, unless it's a good one and you really did get the education there. And I think the reason that the college degrees have been, you know, popular is because it did open up typically a path to a better job. But at the same time, if everybody has that exact same thing, it's just like, now it's like a little better high school diploma, right? If you wanted to separate yourself, you'd have to go to the next school. You'd have to go to, like, graduate school.
Right.
And, well, then, does that free? I mean, it's just, the idea seems great, but it still doesn't work with a supply and demand economy. You can't just imagine, you know, hey, I'm really educated now. Well, there's no job for you.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Supply and demand goes with the workforce, too, and that's, even right now, we're having that problem with college degrees in America, where people have college degrees, but people don't really need to hire college graduates to fulfill their jobs, or the jobs are already filled. And so you have college graduates doing other things, like working at McDonald's or Lowe's, wherever else they can get work. And so we already have that problem. And it wouldn't, education is a solution to a lot of problems, the right kind of education, but it's not the, having a college degree does not guarantee you'll be happy and prosperous, or that you're entitled to an income bracket or something like that. And I think that's where people get off track. And like you said, it would just create more problems on top of the ones we already have if we did do that.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it would actually work too well. And by the way, Abraham, you and I both have degrees. We're not anti-degree. It's just there has to be a job there for you.
Yeah.
The Strait of Hormuz, that's an important part of the world. It's right there in the Persian Gulf area. You got Iran on one side and Iraq on part of it, Saudi Arabia, other parts there, other Middle East nations. And a lot of oil flows through that area, so it is strategically important. Iran, they're always kind of being somewhat belligerent about that. They threaten to close it, and they're doing that again. Iran threatens to close Strait of Hormuz if it faces military action from enemies, they say. Now, they've said this before, but it is worth noting. They say Iran is threatening again to close the Strait of Hormuz, which is a key Persian Gulf shipping route, if the enemy makes a small mistake,
they're not even going to let us make a big mistake. We have to make a small one. they say, if anybody threatens the Islamic Republic, of course, this is boasting by one of their generals, the oil shipping waterway has frequently been the subject of diplomatic clashes between Tehran and Washington. And this general said, if the enemy, which I guess would be us or Israel, makes a small mistake, we will shut the Strait of Hormuz, kill their sedition in the bud, and endanger the arrogant power's interests. So they say this a lot, but they are not that far away from being able to shut that down. Maybe they could already. I'm not totally sure. It is something to consider.
Yeah, you have to take these warnings seriously. And it is interesting just to look at the more we try to reapproach with Iran and give them money and the more weapons they buy from Russia, the more this becomes a reality. And the last time I looked into it, U.S. admirals, they're still confident they could break any blockade that Iran would put on the Straits of Hormuz, but it still is a threat because with advancements in weapons technology, but also the way navies operate nowadays, they're not meant to be in close quarter combat. In other words, the carrier strike groups aren't meant to be close to shore. They're meant to be more long-range strategic assets. But with Straits of Hormuz and even Taiwan, those are the two places where the U.S. thinks they'll have to fight the next war near Taiwan and Straits of Hormuz. There's a big danger because it's within range of land-based cruise missiles, other projectiles that over the last 30 years, there have been attacks in the Falkland Islands, the Gulf War, and the second Gulf War, I think, where cruise missiles, French-made cruise missiles fired by the enemies, did almost sink American ships because it's such close range they can't really do anything about it. So there is a really big inherent danger there besides mines and any other kind of device as well. So they have to take it really seriously, and it does show the foolishness of the strategy right now because we're basically giving Iran the keys to lock down the Straits of Hormuz. But on top of that, and even if we look over to China, we're doing the same thing in the South China Sea. Imagine if China could shut that down like that. A third of the world trade would stop immediately. I mean, that's a lot of power. And we're just giving it to these nations. And that's, you can see the foolishness and the danger in the current U.S. policy.
Right, and even if they couldn't shut it down for long, I mean, what, a couple of days, or the threat of it going on longer? You know how the markets jump around so much. I mean, that could do a lot of damage. It's interesting, even in relation to Iran, with Hillary Clinton's speech last night, part of her speech, she said, you know, we're going to support our allies, and she said something about Israel. And then in the very same sentence, she said she was proud, you know, of the Iranian deal. That's two different things. You know, we're not supporting Israel as an ally when you're allowing Iran to potentially build a nuclear weapon. You can't do both. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a hard thing. I mean, she's probably trying to get votes, the Jewish votes, which
sure.
Even Brett Nuckall talks about that a little bit on the Trumpet Daily, just how American Jews usually vote Democrat most of the time. So I imagine she's trying to appeal to them. But at the same time, you can see how she's not supporting the state of Israel when the leader there is so against the Iran deal, but they support it, and they're willing to give Iran more money than they give Israel in many ways. So it's just a pretty tough position to be in, and you can see just how if she does get in, things aren't going to change with Israel-American relations.
It's hard, and I understand that a politician is going to have to try to reach out to everybody in some way because they want the votes. But at some point, you'd have to take a stand one way or the other. You can't appease everybody. So it's interesting. They're in a tough spot trying to please everybody. This is a really interesting headline, Abraham, that you noticed this morning from Breitbart. Catholic priest said Christians have a moral duty to defeat terror. This is in relation to that killing was earlier this week in France. The priest was killed. Writing for LifeZet.com, Father George Rutler, the pastor of St. Michael's Church in New York City,
argues that not only is such pacifism immoral, it is a Christian duty to protect both oneself and other innocents from violent aggressors. So the Pope was kind of came out and said, well, you know, he did say we're at war, but he said religion should be peaceful, or religion is peaceful, except, of course, when it's not, which would be most of history. but this is kind of another take on that. Some people within the Catholic Church have come out publicly and said, you know, well, you're supposed to turn the other cheek. That's, you know, and this guy says, no, actually, you should, you have a right to defend yourself. And that's kind of the take that he has. And if defending yourself means being aggressive, then doing that. So it's interesting to hear some of this come up. ISIS and these different terror groups, they are really pushing for war. They are pushing for a religious war. That's a very specific act that they perpetrated there in France intentionally. And, it's just this continuous push against Europe and against the Catholic religion.
Yeah, this is really interesting because, like you mentioned, the Catholic Church has been pretty neutral on the issue, or where they have their opinion, but they're not willing to really be necessarily too strong against Muslims in general, or against Islam, or against a terrorist group in particular. But with this, you can see, I think it does. It does illustrate, I think, how a lot of Catholics may feel, a lot of religious people may feel, just because ISIS is a religious terrorist group. I mean, it is, it's an Islamic terrorist group. They have the extreme form of Sharia law, and it is a religion. You can't deny that. So the West is coming, we're coming to this big clash where the liberal secular West that we've liked to promote is having to face the old religious traditions and how people think, and because it's a serious matter. I mean, religion for people, it's you stake your life on it. So when it's under attack, and when something opposed to it is killing people, it's you're gonna have a certain response, and it's hard to control that, or for more secular democracies to keep that in check, or it doesn't dominate more moderate areas, I guess. Like you mentioned, there's a very long history of Islam and Catholicism clashing, and it always has, and the stage is being set for that again, because the Pope can say nice things, and the West can politicians can be politically correct and not address the issue. But there's a billion Catholics in the world that have their own opinion and have their own feelings. And when it's under attack, it's going to be hard to not see a resurrection of that old way of thinking.
Yeah, one of the quotes in that article from Breitbart, there was another official, I think he was a priest or something, and he said, well, it's not the role of the Catholic Church to take up arms. They never really have. They just, other people have,
right,
for the cause. So it's kind of interesting to see, in light of history and in light of prophecy as well, seeing these two religions clash, and it's heating up in that regard. So a lot written about that at thetrumpet.com that you can check out. Some of the big headlines from today: the Key of David program over the weekend here on KPCG. One of the programs is on Europe's dirty secret. Really important program. Europe's got a lot of weapons. They've been talking more openly about getting a more structured military and a more strong military, with Germany at the head. And but they have nuclear weapons as well that are the U.S.'s. And then here in the U.S. with this election, there's a lot of talk about NATO, and we're funding too much. We're spending too much, so they need to take on more of it. And so this program really ties into that. Be careful what you wish for. They might just become that big military force.
Yeah, this is a really good Key of David program, because you are seeing, it was taped a few years ago, but you're seeing it's more relevant even now in this election cycle than it was back then, because of the possible dissolution of NATO. And even I thought it was interesting, in Turkey during the coup, the U.S., because there are nuclear missiles in Turkey, the U.S. base that houses them was basically surrounded, shut down, and almost taken over. They didn't take it over, but they could have. And it does just really illustrate how vulnerable America's nuclear assets are in those NATO countries if they did turn against them, or just want to seize them and use the weapons themselves. So, and not that might happen. Future probability, America would give those weapons to the host countries anyway, because they're built to go on the host nation's planes. The U.S. couldn't even use them anyway. So
right.
I imagine that's the way it will go. But it does show how vulnerable those are, and that this is a huge possibility.
Well, and it's very interesting, too, because one of the things that's being said in this election cycle in the U.S. is, you know, you don't want the Democrats are saying you don't want Donald Trump to have the nuclear codes, which is kind of it takes more than one guy to launch those. It's not like he has a Rolodex or something to push some buttons. I'm not exactly sure how it all works, but from what I've read about it, it's a sequence and there's multiple individuals that have to be on board as a safeguard. But nevertheless, what about all of our weapons in other countries? We're not in control over there. And the more we pull out of funding some of these areas, the more in control they are. And that's the point of this Key of David program. And so it's very interesting to see kind of the fear-mongering of, well, don't give that guy the nuclear codes. Well, what about Turkey? What about Europe? We're comfortable with them having these weapons?
Yeah, it's funny, just the whole West jumps on the whole Trump nuclear story when, if you look at the rest of the world, there's a lot more things to worry about, like proliferation of nuclear weapons everywhere. We're giving Iran nuclear weapons pretty much, and then we're seeing those weapons in the NATO countries. But we're most concerned with, oh, this nominee that could be elected, he could be president, he could have the nuclear codes. Let's focus all our attention on that, and let's not focus on these nations who already have the nuclear weapons and that Iran who threatens to cause a nuclear holocaust. That they're fine. Let's focus on Donald Trump.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot to worry about in all of those scenarios. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show with Brent Nachtigall from Jerusalem. He talked about how Pope Francis is in Poland leading the celebrations of World Youth Day. The event was started by Pope John Paul II. While Pope John Paul was famous for instituting this holiday, he is remembered for far more significant events. During the Cold War, especially in the 1980s, Pope John Paul was instrumental in breaking the hold of the communists on Eastern Europe. He resurrected the geopolitical power of the papacy and reminded the world of the power of the Catholic Church that they hold over Europeans. Most traditions in the continent were fathered by the Catholic Church, and thus even today they wield control over the minds of over 1 billion people that are on this earth. As Europe faces a new threat, the Catholic Church will be center stage in uniting Europe against their common foes. Really ties into even the headlines we were talking about there from Breitbart.
Yeah, it's a something that people don't believe will happen again, or that we're in the 21st century. Those old things those are of the past. But just this recent history, Brent Nachtigall goes over of Pope John Paul, what he did in Poland especially, but how he really changed the course of the Cold War. It wasn't just him, but he had a huge hand to play in it. And you can see just when the papacy chooses to do something, that they do have power. And even Pope Francis has used that too, with in Cuba being a diplomatic third party in a lot of hostile situations. And just if he says something or even gets a picture taken next to something, it means a lot to a lot of people. So he has a lot of power, but we're going to see this used in a new way we haven't seen in a long time, of unifying Europe into and helping the EU finally find that glue that they haven't been able to find before.
And we see that happening in the headlines every day, just about, certainly every week. Make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio Show with Brent Nachtigall coming up this weekend here in KPCG. And as always, if you missed one of the episodes during the week, you can go back and find the archives at kpcg.fm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, take a look at a few things that have happened on this weekend in history.
Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG is produced by the Philadelphia Church of God. The Philadelphia Church of God also publishes the Philadelphia Trumpet, The Trumpet is a free monthly news magazine that analyzes world events. It offers a distinct perspective that compares current news to Bible prophecy. The Trumpet matches prophecy to the United States, Britain, and other nations. The Trumpet is published in Edmond, Oklahoma, alongside KPCG. More information is available at thetrumpet.com.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us online, kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And make sure this weekend you also listen for the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program. Trumpet columnists talk about some of the biggest stories and the biggest trends of the week. So make sure you listen for that program as well. And you can sign up for the Trumpet Weekly Report, which is a PDF. It gets sent to your email inbox every Friday. It's a free service. You can sign up for it at thetrumpet.com and also puts those stories together for you so you can read those. And there's some good links there, too. You can go listen to some audio, watch some video presentations. So really good free service. Make sure you get that at thetrumpet.com, the Trumpet Weekly Report. This is Trumpet Radio Live. Dwight Falk, Abraham Blondeau with you here today. Abraham, you enjoy a burger now and then, don't you?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Everybody likes a hamburger. Do you know some of them aren't good for you? Is this breaking news?
I might have started suspecting that lately, but
turns out some burgers are not good for you. Some could be, depending on how you make them. This is a list from the Daily Meal. America's unhealthiest fast food burgers. This is about to make some people sad. some of the burgers are particularly bad. The worst burger, they're saying, is the Hardee's / Carl Jr.'s Monster Thick Burger. With a name like that, you should expect it to not be good for you. The legendary unhealthy 2/3-pound Monster Thick Burger is a beast of a burger. Contains an insane amount of calories, 1,340 to be exact. And they think most people should get about 2,000 a day, give or take. And it's not just the calories. It's what are the calories consisting of. So it's got a lot of calories and a lot of saturated fat, et cetera, et cetera. And it is big. It is a monster thick burger. You know, it's interesting because where I grew up, they had Hardee's restaurants up north in Wisconsin. Down here in Oklahoma, they're Carl's Jr. But they're kind of the same, but they're kind of different. It's always confused me somewhat.
Yeah. It is something I never understood. I mean, probably some merger or whatever happened. I don't know. But it is, for marketing's sake, you think they just pick one.
Pick one. Stick with it.
Or like in England, Burger King is Hungry Jack's.
Yeah.
In Australia, too, maybe. I think it's Hungry Jack's as well. So, I don't know. Maybe they're trying. That's more appealing to those people than Burger King. But I don't know.
I saw a funny joke years ago where somebody, they were taking it literally, and they said, "Who is this Burger King? Who is this King?" Oof. I thought it was funny. Second worst burger for you. This one hits close to home here. Sonic, because we've got a Sonic within a stone's throw of our studio. Sonic, the bacon double cheeseburger with mayo. That's 1,240 calories. Not a good one. Number three, Wendy's Dave's Triple. You get the single, not good enough. Double, still hungry. Go for that triple. It's what it sounds like. It's three patties there and the bun and everything. There's a lot there. It has 1,070 calories. You can barely get that in your mouth.
Yeah, that's I always had a lot of respect for Wendy's. I don't know why. I guess I never really eat their burgers, though. I eat their chicken and other things. But yeah, three, even for me, three slabs of meat, three patties is a little much.
It's a little much, yeah. The fourth one is Jack in the Box, a sirloin cheeseburger with bacon. All these have bacon for some reason. 1,030 calories on that guy. And coming in at last on the list, Dairy Queen. If you can find a Dairy Queen somewhere, they have the half-pound flamethrower grill burger. Of course they do. It's just over 1,000 calories, 1,010 to be exact. The half-pound flamethrower grill burger. That's a mouthful. I can't eat it. I can't even say it.
Actually, I found one Dairy Queen, I think, maybe in all of Oklahoma. But it's in South Edmond by the Quail Springs down by Memorial Road there. We were just driving around.
Yeah, I've seen that one.
And I saw it. Because I haven't seen one in a lot of places in America, they're not very popular.
There used to be one. There used to be one just in Edmond, but then it turned into some other restaurant. I can't remember exactly which one it turned into, but yeah, you don't see them too often. And then sometimes you're driving through a small town and they've got a knockoff version. It's right. Like their own version. They'll call it like the Dairy Queen or something. And you're like, what is this? You can't do that. But you see those occasionally. So anyway. Those are the five worst burgers in America. I guess as far as like fast food, I mean, you can go to some restaurants and get some pretty, you know, more sit down type establishments and you can pack on the pounds. No doubt there. So, those are the five that are the worst. I like the fifth one. I just like the name. That one sounds pretty cool.
Right.
The half pound flamethrower grill burger. Wow. It sounds hot. It sounds like there's a lot of fire going on there.
If they cooked it with a flamethrower, I would buy it. No matter how many calories they have.
If you could see them do it, yeah. Come out in a welder's mask. Yeah. So those are the burgers, too. Either avoid or go after. It depends on what your goal is. Here are some of the things that have happened on this weekend in history. 1754 on this day, the first international boxing match was held. It's a 25-minute match. It was won when Jack Slack, that doesn't sound like a real name, Jack Slack of Britain knocked out Jean Petit. From France. Well, that makes sense. His the last name is P-E-T-I-T.
Small.
Yeah. No wonder he lost.
Yeah, Small Slack.
Yeah. He lost that one and got knocked unconscious. 1773, on this day, the first schoolhouse to be located west of the Allegheny Mountains was built in Schoenbrunn, Ohio. That was kind of a border where they had to get over that to expand westward. That mountain range is part of the Appalachian Mountain Range between the eastern United States and Canada there. You ever been there?
I've seen them, when I lived on the East Coast, the Appalachians go up into Nova Scotia. But driving through eastern Canada, I have seen them, and I think probably drove through the foothills of them, but I haven't actually been in them.
Yeah, it's interesting growing up, for my kids here in Oklahoma, not really seeing much in the way of mountains. And so sometimes we will be driving somewhere maybe out of state and you see a hill. And my wife grew up near Seattle, so they have quite a few pretty good-sized mountains. And the kids will see it and be like, oh, look at that. You know, it's barely a foothill. It's like, it's not. But compared to here, you know, sometimes those hills aren't bad. Being from Wisconsin, I always think about sledding. I see a hill right. And I'm like, oh, you could get going on the sled on that thing. Zip down that hill. Don't know how you'd stop. Hit the interstate, I guess.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the most drastic way to stop, but it does remind me of Bill Cosby had a sketch really early on in his career, and they go go-karting, or like soapbox racing, I guess, where you just have the wheels and the box, and you just go down the hill,
uh-huh.
And they call it Dead Man's Corner, because the road they do it on spilled into the interstate, so they had to try to stop before they got there, and all they did for a break was put down a piece of wood.
Yeah,
against the ground. Hopefully they'd stop, but
or start a fire.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. One way or the other. 1928 on this day, MGM's Leo the Lion. I think everyone knows him. He roared for the first time. He introduced MGM's first talking picture, White Shadows of the South Seas. So that'd be something, because if you put yourself in their position, you're going to a talking film for the first time, probably. So what's this gonna be exciting? And then a lion roars at you. That's scary to death.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it is my most favorite logo introduction. I mean, nowadays you have like an hour of logos before you even get into the movie because they have all the different studios.
Yeah, you're like, who made this movie?
Yeah.
The animation for the logo was better than the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Interesting. 1940 on this date, John Sigmund of St. Louis, Missouri, completed a 292-mile swim down the Mississippi River. The swim from St. Louis to Carthersville, Missouri, took him 89 hours and 48 minutes. He must have taken quite a few breaks.
Or just floated.
Just floated.
Yeah, swimming might be, maybe he did, but because it does flow downriver. So.
Yeah, he was smart going down.
Yeah.
But was it on purpose, or did he just fall in, just float down to the bottom? He barely, everyone thought he could do this great thing. He barely survived, probably. 1945 on this day, this is interesting, the USS Indianapolis was torpedoed by a Japanese submarine. The ship had just delivered key components of the Hiroshima atomic bomb to the Pacific Island. of Trinian. About only 316 out of 1,196 men aboard survived the attack. So it's interesting you look at that because, if it had happened earlier, it would have totally thwarted the U.S.'s plans.
Right. Yeah, that's a near miss and tragic, too, that so many sailors lost their lives. And you don't there weren't a lot of ships sank, capital ships sank, for the Americans in World War II. Midway, they lost, I think, two aircraft carriers, if I remember. And they lost some other ships. But, yeah, this one's famous because of the near miss, but also the loss of life.
Right. 1955 on this day, some Canadian pride here. Marilyn Bell of Toronto, Canada, at the age of 17, became the youngest person to swim the English Channel. There you go.
Yeah.
So she did it at 17. I was thinking about the river guy still thinking about the guy that went down the Mississippi, if it was intentional or not. But they should have met up. We would have had a lot to talk about, I guess.
That's right. Yeah.
1957 on this day, Jack Parr began hosting The Tonight Show on NBC. The name of the show was changed to The Jack Parr Show. Parr was host for 5 years. And then, of course, The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson, very famous. You can still catch reruns of that on certain channels. And it is funny. I don't see them very often, but occasionally I'll stop for a minute or two. And just the culture, how different it was, how different people, they conducted themselves in a different way. Even in a comedy entertainment show, it was just a little different than, well, actually, it was a lot different than what we see today.
Right. Still has some dignity and good-natured humor. And I mean, to be honest, Johnny Carson is still my favorite talk show host. He just was really good at it. And I think, but also that time period, there were a lot of funny people coming on, like Bob Hope and a lot of more people who had a quick wit, I guess, than today, where it's more insults are funny than actual good humor.
Yeah, it's such a different world today. With social media, I think, in particular, has changed things a lot. 1971 on this day, men rode in a vehicle on the moon for the first time in a lunar rover vehicle, which would be kind of interesting. Of course, we've all seen footage of that, I think. Don't know what kind of gas mileage they got.
Moon mileage.
Moon mileage. How many moon miles can you go in this thing? And it wasn't solar powered, right? It was on the moon. Yes, thank you. 1981 on this day, England's Prince Charles and Lady Diana Spencer were married. Of course, that did not end well, but was quite the ceremony and watched by the world, as all those royal weddings are. 1989 on this day, the Game Boy handheld video game device was released in the U.S. You ever have one of those?
Actually, I think I have one of the first ones, like that front of that series in 1989.
You still have it?
Yep.
Oh, does it work?
Yes. Yeah, it works fine, and it's black. Like the screen's black and white, and it's big gray.
Yep.
Game Boy. It's bigger than the Game Boys that came out later. But yeah, it's pretty cool to have. It's just a nice memento of the past.
Yeah, I was going to say that might be a collector's item of some kind.
Yeah, I got it at a yard sale.
Huh.
I just saw it there. I'm like, oh, why not?
Give it a shot and see what happens. What games does it have?
I had like Pac-Man, Tetris, Mario. I had a few. I forget the other ones it had. Dr. Mario. Huh. I never understood that one, though. But I had a bunch of other ones, but all the basics.
It is funny when, I think maybe we've mentioned this before, but it is funny when you have a video game and you don't know how it works. Like you don't understand what you're doing and you still play. I had one of those. I have no idea what the point of it was. I'm probably just really slow, but it was on like a Martian planet and I had to walk around. I don't know what I was trying to do. Like I knew I could make it the player do certain things, but I don't know why. I never seemed to get anywhere. And right. I tried and I just thought, I don't know what this is.
Well, it's before they gave you an instruction manual. Like, this is the objective, or they tell you what you're supposed to do. Those older ones, you just start playing, and you're like, oh, I guess this is what I'm doing. I have no idea.
Pac-Man was pretty obvious what yeah. you're doing. But this guy just walked around, and I could make him, like, jump, and I don't know why, though. I still don't know why. Here's one we're going to talk about a little bit more today. 1588 on this day, the English defeated the Spanish Armada in the Battle of Gravelines.
Yeah, this is the famous battle that essentially ended the threat of the Spanish Armada, the invasion of Spain on England during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. So a very famous event, and I think it's pretty relevant, and it's interesting because it, for two different ways of looking at it, two different angles. The first one is it showed in the wake of Brexit, this was, I think, the defining moment when England was able to solidify its breaking away from Catholic Europe. So this really, really did define that England would be always Protestant and different from a Catholic mainland. So that was like a big geopolitical event where England got her sovereignty and it remained that way forever so far. And the second angle also is just reviewing the importance of sea power. And at this time, England and Spain were battling over control of the world trade routes. And we're seeing this replay now in modern times between China and America. So from these two different angles, it is important to review this history because it we're seeing in a way, a repetition of these same trends. And to start, I have a quote from Sir Walter Raleigh. He was admiral and administrator during the reign of Elizabeth I. And I think he sums up really well what was at stake at this battle. And he said, "Whoever commands the sea commands the trade. Whoever commands the trade of the world commands the riches of the world, and consequently the world itself." And so it is he brings out a great point that is always true, that whoever has the biggest navy and controls the world trade, that you are the world power. And that was true for the British Empire, well, the Spanish Empire here, the British Empire, and now the, America.
Yeah, and that seems like something that, at least here in the U.S., people don't think about quite as much anymore. You don't hear anything in any of these campaign speeches about military power, really, somewhat make the military strong. You do hear some of that, but it is true. You do have to control trade, and there is almost I don't know if this is the way people think about it in general, but it seems like there might be sort of an idea that was last century. It doesn't matter anymore. We're beyond that, but the reality is you have to have physical goods get to your nation somehow and leave your nation if you're selling them. You can't email at all. You can't. There is still a very real world, physical, touch this, put this here, ship it there, that you need to be able to do if you're going to be powerful.
Right. Yeah. I think something the public, or it's been lost from the public eye, especially with nuclear weapons. A lot of our attention is on that kind of strategy, which is important too. Don't get me wrong, but we forget about some of the basics of establishing world power. And why America needs a big navy, and why it has to be maintained, because if we're seeing that now, that if America withdrew its navy, all these other powers would suddenly control the world instead of us, and that's really the basic of it, because the goods and services can't get to you if you're not controlling the vital choke points and sea routes in the world that allow trade to flow. And at this time, in the 1500s, Spain, they had a huge empire in Europe, but also in South America, in Florida and the Bahamas, where they would get the bullion, the sea, the silver, the gold, the spices, everything, shipped them to Europe. And they were rich. And England, they were late to the empire game, but they were they had some gifted admirals. One was Sir Francis Drake. And basically, the English were pirates. They would raid the Spanish trade routes and try to break their power and hold on the Atlantic trade lines. And they were very, very successful at this. In fact, in 1587, so the year before this battle took place, they tried to stop the buildup of the Spanish Armada and attacked Cadiz, which is in southern Spain there, right where the Battle of Trafalgar was fought, just outside of that. 300 years later, but it's the only time someone has actually been able to break the impregnable fortress of Cadiz, get in and destroy all the Spanish ships, and that was Sir Francis Drake. So he was a brilliant man. He was character-wise, there's a lot of controversy on that, but he was probably the ablest Englishman there. And Queen Elizabeth asked him to help defend the country when Spain wanted to defeat England, and this was partly because of them raiding the lines, but also because the Catholics wanted to control England. And it was this battle here where England was able to, with a miracle, were able to defeat the Spanish, Spain waned and England rose to power.
It's very difficult to say Spain waned.
Yes.
That's quite a feat in and of itself. 1588 on this day, the English defeated the Spanish Armada in the Battle of Gravelines. Those are some of the things that have happened on this day and this weekend in history. Thanks for joining us today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show, and the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program this weekend here on KPCG. That'll do it for myself, Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondeau. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.